We finished talking about the Zebroi Boehm model, and now we'll start talking about the many worlds interpretation. And this goes back to a paper by Hugh Everett III. In 1957. And so there's been a lot of work and even more discussion on the many worlds interpretation. I'm going to give you the version due to David Wallace, who's a philosopher. But there's many other takes on the many worlds approach. So let's begin with the axioms. Number one, the ontology at time t is given by the wave function. Number two, the wave function evolves according to the Schrödinger equation. And that's it. So that's the idea. That's all the axioms of the many worlds interpretation. These two things. And then the idea is to see if this really makes any sense. Is it possible that this could be everything? So the claim is that this is sufficient. So the claim is that it's sufficient to do two things. First of all, recover the appearances of the world. So you have tables and chairs and so on. And secondly, it's sufficient to recover the empirical content of quantum theory, i.e. the probabilistic predictions. Thank you. Okay. So anyway, like I said, there's a vast literature on Immanuel's approach. I personally don't like Immanuel's approach. I would even regard myself as an anti-advocate. However, my job here is to do the best I can to present a coherent version. And so I'm going to go with the version due to David Wallace. You can find talks, well, there's also papers, but you can find two talks by David Wallace on PERSA. And there's our PERSA 050103 and also 16. So these talks were part of a school we had where people were brought to a Perimeter Institute who represented different approaches to quantum foundations. So in fact, both Anton Zeilinger and Alain Aspect also gave talks. So, so it's worth the collection, part of the collection. C-O-5-0-0-1. So if you're interested in looking at those lectures, there they are. So there's two problems that really I've sort of stated them here. Let me just state them again. That the two problems that Wallace needs to solve. Two problems he attempts to solve. So one is, where does the world structure come from? And in what basis? And number two, where does the Born rule come from? The Born rule is just refers to the fact that you take the square of amplitudes. Get probabilities. The approach that David Wallace takes to this, the first problem is strongly influenced by another philosopher, Simon Saunders. And I would say that this part of the attempt is successful, I think. They successfully, Wallace, influenced by Saunders, successfully say where this world structure comes from. And then the second problem, explain where probability comes from. So this is influenced by David Deutsch. And I would say that the jury is still out, whether but it's an interesting thing that David Wallace and David Deutsch try to do.
What does the basis mean in the second one?
What basis? So I think you may remember in an earlier lecture I pointed out in the measurement problem, one of the problems is to say what is the basis with respect to which you see definite states. Because just mathematically you could imagine that you see definite states in a basis that's consists of macroscopic superpositions. So you need to say why do we see the world in the basis?
Could you also explain what world structure means?
So that will so the idea of the many worlds approach is that you is, you know, normally it's described as, you know, every time there is a measurement you get a splitting and the whole universe divides into two worlds. One in which you have one outcome of the measurement and then another, or maybe many worlds if you have many outcomes. So one in which you have that one outcome and then in which you have the other outcome. Or if you have 10 outcomes, then 10 worlds. So there's this kind of structure of worlds that you're supposed to get, and where does that come from? You might take, you might say, well, this is splitting is something that happens after a measurement, but then you have to say, well, what is a measurement? You have to stop with that problem. So then you might say, well, the splitting happens every single time any microscopic event happens. It's not very clear what that means because you need to solve the basis problem, but also it seems rather radical that there are that many worlds. And do you, is then if you really believe that, then it seems like you have to add another axiom here, which is that there is splitting every single time. And we don't have that here. And the approach that David Wallace takes is to say that the world structure is emergent. It's not there fundamentally, but it's something which is emergent at a macroscopic level. So he says that you get this emergence of quasi-classical worlds. And he uses an analogy. His analogy is tigers. Imagine you have tigers and you want to study tigers. There's sort of three different things you could imagine doing. You could think of tigers as collections of atoms, fundamental particles. Like 10 to one, an individual tiger would have, you know, roughly 10 to the power of 35 particles inside it. And you could imagine trying to solve all the equations, each of those particles, sort of for all those particles collectively. So this would be an incredibly difficult thing to do, to try and explain the tigers. So nobody would attempt to do that if they were studying tigers. Another thing you might do is study, you know, the tigers at a slightly less microscopic level. You might discuss, might study the cell structure. And so it would have a similar problem. There's a lot of cells. You've got to account for how all those cells interacted and so on. It would also be very complicated. So that's not what people do either when they study tigers. What you can do instead, and this is what people actually do, is you can study tigers more from a sort of zoological perspective, about hunting patterns, eating patterns, and so on. So you're studying tigers at a macroscopic level. So that the fact that you do that doesn't mean that you're denying that there are, that tigers are built out of atoms. It's just a convenient way of discussing, of studying tigers, it makes sense. And there's nothing wrong with that from a fundamental physics point of view. And his idea is that measurements and this emergence of worlds is the same, that the emergence of worlds concerns a sort of a macroscopic domain where you have big things like measurement apparatuses. And so one should study those in an appropriate language, not try to think about it, not try to think about it at the very microscopic level. So you get and so therefore you don't need the if you can get this branching structure to emerge at a macroscopic level, a quasi macroscopic level, then that's sufficient. So that's the idea. And he basically uses decoherence to argue that. Okay, so. So to illustrate this, let's just consider, illustrate how these worlds come about. Let's consider an experiment where we have a particle system. It passes through one measurement apparatus, and then it passes through another one. And it comes out the other side. And after each, at each measurement apparatus, there are possible outcomes, one or two. So the initial state is some state for the system going in, and then the two measurement apparatuses in the zero state. Excuse me. Then, well, after the first measurement, after this measurement, what you have is this. I've expanded the state of the system coming in as alpha A1 plus beta A2, where A1 and A2 are the eigenstates of the operator associated with this measurement. And then I've, in the case of A1, it causes the outcome 1. In the event of A2, it causes the outcome A2. That's just straightforward quantum theory. And then you can evolve it some more through the second beam splitter. And to do that, you want to expand each of these eigenstates in terms of eigenvalues associated with this measurement, operator here. And I'll just write down what you get. Alpha, gamma. So I've expanded A1 as gamma B1 plus delta B2. And then A2 has to be orthogonal to that. So I've expanded it as minus delta star B1 plus gamma star B2. That will be orthogonal.
Second term at the second line, B should be B2.
Which second term? Well, here. No.
Second beta.
Second, this term?
Yeah, well, the term D, beta A2.
Oh, yeah, have I made a mistake? So, B1, 2, B1, B2. Is it okay? Okay, good. Thanks.
Only last term should be A2.
A2. Okay. See? That does seem right, yes. Thank you. So here's the branching structure, the Walt structure, call it. So we can imagine, and initially we have the two apoapoptosis are in the zero states. And then we have some sort of branching where either we get A1 or we get A2. And then we have further branching on each of these branches. A1, E1, A1, E2. B1, A2. And if we made more measurements, then we'd have more and more branching. So we can sort of pick out this structure here in this wave function as it evolves. But one question is, why are we choosing the basis that we've chosen? The basis problem. Picking these bases, you know, we could have instead taken instead. And the argument there appeals to it having further entanglement with the environment and then decoherence. So these measurement apparatuses will be subject to entanglement really of two types. First of all, entanglement with the internal degrees of freedom of the measurement apparatuses themselves. And in addition to that, entanglement with particles in the environment, molecules in the air, light that's emitted, light that hits the apparatus and then scatters. All of those things will get entangled states. So, so for example, interaction with the environment. So, for example, we could have the A measurement apparatus, and then some initial environment state, and that's going to go to some state like this. And this will happen very quickly. And then we'll have that these two states will be more or less orthogonal. So now you can see it's difficult to have this basis because if you had a basis like this, evolving, that would go. And it would be entangled with the environment. So this basis would kind of disappear, and you'd really just be left with this is the basis that you want to use. So if you use this basis, okay, then you get a kind of stable emergent structure. Use a different basis, it's very unstable very quickly. Yeah. So that's the argument for the basis. Are there any comments at this stage? Any questions? Go ahead.
Is the size of the Hilbert space fixed as the system evolves?
I think people in the many worlds approach sort of tend to take a sort of whole universe approach to imagining the state of the universe. So here you've got, you know, this is part of the that you're kind of the environment could just be everything else in. So then it is fixed.
Because, like, if we're trying to create an orthogonal basis for every branch, I feel like we could run out of room in enough time. Keep not interacting as they evolve.
I mean, there's a lot of particles around, and we need to just account for appearances. You know, certainly during our lifetime, enough room to do that. And this is only a sort of an emergent structure you're trying to pick out. So I think you're. Interesting question. Yep, go ahead.
My question is why couldn't you just write A1 plus minus A2 as to some other state A3 and then say like A3 E naught goes to
I was trying to show that there's a problem with that. So I can write these as A3, 4. Okay, so those two states interacting with the environment. Let's call it 0. See, if I write A1, 2, then afterwards we have this. And the original state still factors out. Okay. Whereas that's not the case here. You can't factor out the original state. You have something like this. It gets entangled.
So we're saying that, like, the measurement device responds to a particular basis?
Yeah, no, there's a reason for this, which is that the sorts of Hamiltonians we have in nature typically are local in position. The kind of evolution is, the sorts of typical evolution we have are special with regard to position. So these outcomes are things that happen, like in position space, either pointer goes here or here, and so when the environment interacts with it, it's interacting with something which has got some quasi-local features already. Whereas these states are non-local, very non-local, and so the environment will quickly get entangled with them. So it's because Hamiltonians, typical Hamiltonians in nature, are local,
Is it possible? Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Sounded like the beginning of an interesting question. Okay. Yeah, so this is an important point. Well, no question mark, it evolves to this. So yeah, Hamiltonians. Yeah, they tend to favor decoherence in a preferred basis that is itself local. There's a very good framework. I think I may have mentioned it before, called the consistent histories or the decoherent histories approach. Because you have histories here, it's a very good framework for studying these situations in there. And then you can get an even better mathematical handle on how this structure emerges. And how decoherence of the environment picks out this particular structure, not one in some other basis.
Could you explain what the x is a position?
Yeah, I meant position, yeah. So position in space.
And how is it related to the preference?
Well, Hamiltonians, when you write Hamiltonians down, they typically contain terms which are local in position, and it doesn't have terms which are non-local across different positions.
How do you relate to the choice of basis?
What happens is if you choose a basis here, if this basis is something which is local, as for example a pointer, imagine the pointer for here is fairly local. Like this, then this kind of state, when it interacts with the environment, will tend to be preserved, although it will get entangled. It will get correlated with the environment, not entangled. Whereas a state which is non-local, like this, when it interacts with an environment, and because of the nature of Hamiltonians, this will get entangled. This state will not be preserved.
Like A1 and A2 are some states, like spatial
being very far. They're A1 and A2 are. They you can think of them as if these apparatuses have pointers. If they will correspond to different positions for these pointers. So just, well, in this case, just two. So they're far away in that sense. Okay. So that's. That's the emergence of this world structure. And the important thing to note is in this Wallis version, you don't have a fundamental axiom that says there is splitting at some microscopic level. That maybe is less fun, but more the kind of thing you expect is not to have a splitting axiom. And that's the easier part of making the many worlds interpretation work. The harder part is understanding probability. So, let me work on that. I'll use these three blackboards. I didn't erase that. Sorry.
By microscopic word, we don't refer to some like energy limit or something. We're just talking about like some operation on some of the, some preparation or like the meaning of microscopic word.
I think that the role that macroscopic is playing here is to make things irreversible. If you could have make things effectively irreversible. You know, if you were to look at this. If you were to do this at a for much smaller systems like individual, you know, photons or electrons or something, and try to find this branching structure, you get a lot of recombinations.
Okay, so
because of interference phenomena, whereas here, because everything is big, recombination having two paths overlap again is very unlikely.
The only microscopic level is initial condition then, because all the time when all of the Hamiltonians, quantum Hamiltonians are not reversible.
The Hamiltonians are they're time symmetric. It's just it's just entropy type considerations. You've got a lot of particles in a messy way. They don't tend to go back, you know, under even under time reversible evolution. Okay, so probability. In the Monowolf's interpretation. So the problem the basic problem is that in the many worlds interpretation, the many worlds approach, everything happens. Like pretty much everything that can happen does happen. Everything that has non-zero probability certainly happens.
Okay.
And in quantum theory, especially if you go to quantum field theory, pretty much everything has a non-zero amplitude. Every possible thing you can imagine, no matter how terrible, definitely happens. No matter what approach. Right now, here in this room, everywhere, it's all that stuff is happening. Let's just write down the equation. Imagine if beta. Is equal to 10 to the minus 100. Actually, last time I gave this lecture, I used 10 to the minus 100. Why not use 10 to the minus 1,000? Even smaller. Well, then, in the regular understanding of quantum theory, you would say that the probability of seeing this outcome, A2, is 10 to the minus 2,000. But in the many worlds approach, this definitely happens. So why don't we just write the probability is equal to 1? And even if you want to have a probability, why would we write this probability? Why not write, well, there's two things that can happen. Let's just say they're both equally likely. And it's important, you know, if you find yourself in this world with the low amplitude, which definitely happens, then, you know, colors are just as bright. People are not kind of tired because they're in a low amplitude world, not drowsy. Everything is just as vivid. It's a world just like any other world. Okay, it has a low amplitude attached to it, but in this approach, it definitely happens, and it's the same as any other world. So why would you care about beta in this case? So what I want to do is sketch, but not go into a lot of detail, the approach that David Wallace takes to this. And the idea is to use a branch of mathematics called decision theory. So decision theory. So and you know, this has been developed by people not thinking about quantum theory. There's a book by L. Savage. Called Foundations of Statistics. From I forget the year, from a long time ago. This talks about, you know, decision theoretic axioms. So you have, you imagine, you know, how a rational agent will behave and how we will ascribe probabilities to events. So what this concerns is you have states S, and S states S are things things that can happen. This is classical, of course. Yes. So there's just things that you can that can happen. And then you have rewards. The different things that happen, you might get different rewards. And you have bets. Probably it is if I round. So different bets that you might make.
Okay.
These bets have different rewards. And then you impose a whole bunch of axioms on this structure. And one kind of axiom you might impose is that maybe you might say, well, maybe that you have two bets, B1 and B2. And this notation means that you prefer bet 1 to bet 2. So the bet is you place the bet, and then if you get a certain outcome, then you either win or lose. If you win, you get the reward. So an axiom might be something like this. You prefer this bet to this bet and this bet to this bet, then you'd better prefer bet 1 to bet 3. And there's lots of different axioms which are by appealing to some sort of rational some sort of idea of a rational agent. And I'm not going to write down those axioms. I'm just trying to give you a flavor of how this argument works. And then what you can do within this this theory is you can get a representation theorem. That there exists a unique measure over these outcomes and also so you get this representation theorem, which is basically telling you that you can attribute a probability to these different states. So this is good because you're getting something like probability emerging out of a sort of general decision theoretic framework. But what you want now probability is given by the amplitude squared. So it's good to have this representation theorem, but now you want to show that the probability is given by this amplitude squared. So Wallace introduces a set of axioms which apply these decision theoretic ideas to the branching structure.
Let's see.
There. Okay. Then he ends up deriving the Born rule. So what can I say about this? So one thing that's used here is it's called so it's a certain principle that's used in reasoning here. It's called the principle. One of the great things about philosophy is that they have all these colorful names for things. a rational agent who knows that the objective probability of something is P is required to choose this as his subjective probability. So there's two notions, the notion of an objective probability and the notion of a subjective probability. And if you think about the decision theoretic frameworks, if you're just involved in making decisions, and you've got this this measure on outcomes, well, that can just be a subjective measure. That can just be your probabilities for different things happening, you know, that you feel like the probability is such and such. And a different person might have a different subjective probabilities, and that's fine for a lot of situations. But in fundamental physics, where you have things like radioactive atoms decaying, okay, if you believe that the half-life of uranium is one thing, and if another person believes it's another thing, well, we kind of think that one of those people is wrong. There is an actual answer to that question. So there's something in physics that corresponds to objective probabilities. And this principle is a bridge between those things. So, you know, if you know that the objective probabilities are such and such a thing, then you're required to make your beliefs align with that. So that's a principle. Okay. So I'm not going to go through how Wallace does this proof. In any case, even if I did, I would only give a sketch, and I think it's better that you go and look at the paper. But roughly speaking, first of all, he proves that if two events have the same amplitude, the same weight at least, then agents are rationally required to give them the same probability. And then the second thing he proves, and this he calls this the equivalence rule. The second thing he proves is that the equivalence rule implies the Born rule. Okay, so it's a piece of mathematics. There's lots of assumptions. There's lots of assertions about what it means to be a rational agent. And after all that, he gets this Born rule. So let me just in some blackboard space. If you're interested in this, I recommend looking at the talk I mentioned somewhere there. The second talk is the one about probability. Okay, so there's lots of criticisms. I'm just going to quickly go through this so then I can move on to collapse on Wednesday. So one, a lot of people think this account of probabilities doesn't quite work. And various people, Adrian Kent, David Albert, Hugh Price, many others have criticized this argument in papers and talks. There was an interesting conference on the many walls interpretation here. There was one here, and there was a conference in Oxford. There's two conferences that were organized by the same people. And that was 50 years after the many walls paper, so 2007. So you can find that conference, and you'll see people criticizing the argument of David Wallace. So. And basically, you can say, well, I don't care what you, David Wallace, say. I have a different measure of probabilities. And there's not really anything you can do about that, because you're just saying I don't accept your various axioms and principles of rationality. Second criticism is that it's... it's distasteful, sorry. This is only partly a joke. If you you're in an interpretation where everything happens. Okay. So, like I said, you can imagine some pretty horrible things that can happen. If you're in a stochastic model, then you can also imagine horrible things that might happen. But if they didn't happen, you kind of got away with it. Whereas in this approach, you didn't get away with it. All those things happened. It's just you don't have to be necessarily in those branches. I think if you really believe that, it would affect the way you felt, I think. It's a very real, visceral thing. So I remember one time I was driving and I blew out and I almost crashed. I didn't crash, but probably in some world I did crash. That wouldn't matter for me because I'd be dead. But there'd be people in that world where I was dead who'd be really upset. And so that's I hope. And that's a weird thing to think if you really believe that. The usual response to this kind of remark from people in many worlds approach is, well, science is like that. It's kind of tough, just like we used to have this very cozy worldview where the Earth was at the center and the universe was all around us. It was a very cozy feeling. And now we don't have that. We don't have that point of view. We're much more insignificant in some sense. The same argument is used here. That's just the way it is. This is what quantum theory tells us. Tough. I think that's fine. Except that if you're going to believe something as radical as this, then you better be sure it's true. You don't want to just believe it and then it turns out that it's not really true. And that which brings me to the third point, which is that progress in physics might well change the very features of quantum theory that make this interpretation what it is. In particular, if this progress ends up getting rid of unitary evolution becomes something And there's lots of reasons from quantum gravity to think that that might be the case. So so those are the sort of main criticisms. I could go on. One of the things I found at conferences is that the discussion of many-worlds, the many-worlds approach tends to fill the time available. Anyway, I'll stop there. But you're welcome to ask questions.
I have questions about how the weight for each events are assigned there.
How the weights? In which sense? Sorry,
in the first step, is stating that the same. Like we have to first assign the weight for each events, like alpha square.
Okay. So if you the argument here is if you look at the wave function and you have two branches, those branches have the same amplitude on them, and you can see this amplitude from here, for example. Imagine if this and this were equal. Okay, those would be two branches that have the same weight.
So
then.
Sorry. The square of the amplitude is kind of.
Is the weight? Yeah. Really, the main thing about the weight is that you're ignoring the phase information. The magnitude of these terms. If you have two, so the argument number one is he ends up showing that if two terms have the same magnitude, then they should have the same probability. And I'm not giving you the details of that argument. You have to go to the lecture. Okay. Any other?
Argument. I don't really understand what does like probability is the probability of what? It's not probability of occurrence anymore.
Of what? Sorry.
It's not the what is probability? Like it's the probability of what here?
I think so. In the first place, it's the probability we use to make decisions. So here's a different example. Imagine you go into a cloning machine. So you go into a machine, and out of that machine come two copies of you. Okay, how would you reason in such a situation? How would you make decisions? You know, like maybe one copy goes to one place, and another copy goes to the other place. How would you think about that? Would you, because your experience would be you go in and you just come out in one place, even though there are two copies of you. So how would you reason in such a situation? How would you make decisions? I don't think
like the probability of me as an observer deciding that which part of the wave function I want to measure. Is it that?
So there is a problem for this approach, which is it talks about decisions, and decisions are usually choices you make. But the whole thing is deterministic. It's got a wave function evolving in time. Nevertheless, in quantum theory, you can have the idea that you're making choices of different measurements and so on. So you know, the setting is one way or another. And you can make, you could make decisions, do I want the setting to be this way or this way, according to what will happen afterwards.
So the probability, what actually it's doing is that it's affecting the measurement machine, like it's actually telling that what measurement machine is going to measure somehow. Like it says that you don't have free will; you're going to like measure this thing with this probability because, like, all of these things are happening. But
yeah, everything happens, but you you know, nevertheless, you have the feeling that you're making decisions and betting on things. Like imagine you're you know, if you cross the road, every time you cross the road, you make a bet. You know, you say, okay, now is a safe time to cross. At least the probability of you know, some truck or something coming along is very small. So you're making decisions based on your beliefs about what the probabilities are. So that's an idea of what probabilities do. They help you make decisions. And he's trying to take that idea about probabilities in the context of a decision theoretic framework and apply them to the branching structure that we have over here to make sense of it.
this cloning argument, like if you know that in there's like three copies of you cloned and two of you are sent to the same place,
yeah,
then as a rational agent you assign more probability being sent to that place.
I think that might be an analogy, yeah. I think that's right.
Like if you like enter a dark room and then you know that you're gonna be cloned in three copies, two copies of you will be sent to Toronto and one copy will be sent to Vancouver. Like when you walk into the room and you know that, you'll say like, okay, there's like 60% chance that when I wake up I'm in Vancouver.
But you're going to like all of these things are going to in like the cloning.
But you only have one experience. You don't have multiple experiences.
But I thought the whole argument is about that all of these experiences are going to happen at the same time.
Even though they all happen, your experience as an individual will only be to see one of them.
Your experience as a local measurement machine that can only.
Or as a human, you know, your experience is only to be in one of those worlds. Yeah. Because that's the experience we have. So it's very analogous to this cloning situation. And we have to find ways to, if you believe the many worlds interpretation, that all these branches happen, but you only end up in one branch, then we have to find a way to reason
situation. Could you explain again, like, where is the principle is used in the proof? Where is it used in the proof?
Oh, and I didn't show you. I was just trying to show you. I feel bad about this. I really didn't give you a very thorough explanation of how this worked. I was just trying to give you a feel for the kind of territory that this proof was in. So I didn't explain where this worked. You can get more out of David Wallace's talk, which is on the person. Okay, I think I'd better go because there's another lecture in here.